Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Paul Borthwick. I'm privileged to take you on a journey today around the world as we talk about going around the world, looking at the Church of Jesus Christ and the world in which we live. And we're going to try to go around the world in 60 minutes. What we'll do is I'll give my presentation and then have somewhere between 25 and 30 minutes left for some questions. Now, it's a rather presumptuous task to think that I'm going to tell you about the whole world in 60 minutes. But I am going to try to give you an overview for three reasons. One is, I hope that you'll leave here today saying, I did not know that. So this is the purpose is informational. Second is, I hope you'll leave here feeling a little encouraged about something that you hear. Because, you know, God's doing something and you're part of it, and that's your family, and your family just got bigger and you're encouraged by it. And thirdly, I'm going to go through actually a total of 9 points, and any one of these could create in you some sense of where you want to dive in. Because some of the issues I'm going to be talking about require that people dedicate maybe their whole lives to that particular issue. And as the church around the world is growing qualitatively and quantitatively, we need people who are committed to being involved in making the church what Jesus wants it to be. Now, at Urbana, you don't sell things from workshops, but they encourage us to let you know about books that are in the bookstore. And I actually have 4 or 5 books in the bookstore. 2 of them are on basic building your mission vision. One's called A Mind for Missions, and another one's called How to Be a World-Class Christian, which was just re-released this month, actually, the month of December. That's in the bookstore. There's a missions inductive Bible study guide prepared for Urbana 2000 called Missions God's Heart for the World. There's a very challenging book, I think it's challenging, in terms of asking if we believe what we say we believe or if we live out what we say we believe. It's called 6 Dangerous Questions to Transform Your View of the World. And the last one is along the lines of downsizing our American lifestyle, basically to use the bumper sticker to live more simply than others may simply live. The book is simply called Simplify. And it's basically some ideas that you can use, little bullets that you can use in your own reading. So those are available, and I'll quote from some other books that you might want to consider getting as well. My background is as first a youth pastor. Actually, my first journey to Urbana was 1973, when I was 19 years old. And if I could repeat a story that Ramez told this morning, in 1973, I came to Urbana, heard the call to commitment, to commit to myself to wherever God would have me, and I stood on the night of the commitment. And at that same Urbana, a young woman from Cambridge, Massachusetts, named Mary Christine Collazo, she was also there, and she stood that night. And 3 years later, when I was reporting at our church about Urbana 76, I met her. And she's my wife now of more than 30 years. So that's my way of telling you, now listen now, your future spouse could be in this room. But don't waste your time looking for him or her. God will bring you together at his time and whatever. So don't, you know, and don't fall in love with the people on the screen. That happens every year at Urbana. Somebody's singing on the thing and some guy's writing notes or some woman sending, you know, what's it called, Twitters and tweets and, you know, I love you. And it's like I'm married, you know. Anyhow, so just keep that in mind. And my background was as a youth pastor, then a missions pastor, and now I actually work with a leadership development group that takes me into other parts of the world, the so-called majority world, Africa, Asia, Latin America, between 2 and 4 months of the year. And most of the work we do now is directly with indigenous leadership. But what I mean by that is the people that are from that place. So if I'm in Nigeria, I'm working with Nigerians. If I'm in India, working with Indians, etc. And some of the thoughts that I'll share with you today are from that. Now, 2 words about the presentation itself. Number one is you're going to have to take notes. If you want to remember it, because there's 9 points, or 3 3-point sermons, whatever way you want to do it. But there's 9 points, and I didn't produce a handout, because I figured at Urbana what happens is it gets lost in the pile and yet another forest has been destroyed by my workshop. All right. Secondly is I do not do well with technology. I was born before technology. And with the quality of presentations you get at Urbana, I decided no PowerPoint I produce is going to do much of anything for you. So as I told the group earlier, my presentation is fundamentally powerless and pointless. But there is actually no video to see or anything like that. So nothing's broken down except maybe me. All right, so 9 things that are happening. I'm going to use the word great to describe them all. And things that you need to know about the church around the world or the fact of life around the world in terms of what's happening. And it's important for us to know because when you hear it Urbana, you can think, man, I'm part of the happening place. And you are. But the United States and Canada together are less than 6% of the world's population. So that means 94% of the world lives outside of those two nations. And so there's a lot of stuff God's doing beyond ourselves, and we need to either know about it or be able to join into it. And so I'm going to use the word great, and I'll spend the most time on great number 3. And I'll try to make sure you get them so that you can follow along. But the first great that's happening in the world is what I simply call the Great Transition. The Great Transition. Somewhere in the 1980s, statisticians started to report the fact that from the best they could tell, the Church of Jesus Christ was, for the first time, maybe since the first century, predominantly non-Western. In other words, most of our Christian brothers and sisters live in the Southern Hemisphere and the Eastern Hemisphere. So even though the Western world has dominated Christianity for most of Christian history, now you're seeing Christianity by primarily a non-white, non-Western, and I like to add in non-wealthy religion. Philip Jenkins in his books, The Next Christendom, says, if you want to imagine a typical Christian in the world, think of a poor woman in a slum in São Paulo, Brazil, or a poor woman in a village in Nigeria. Our brothers and sisters are fundamentally from other places. And as we think about it, you saw it on the video last night, Africa will be the most Christian continent on earth by 2025, if the growth continues. And, you know, it's just an amazing thing in terms of things like the transition from the Western world to the non-West. And the transition also includes the connectivity of the world. You know, we know the word globalization. And the world is getting connected in a way it's never been before. But in addition to that, in the Christian church around the world, the gospel's growing, and more churches, more and more countries are owning the vision to be part of the missionary enterprise. So you'll hear the phrase that the church is going from every nation to every nation. I go to church in Lexington, Massachusetts, where the Revolutionary War started. American history. I live on Minuteman Lane. Huh? Okay, well, I'm glad you know a lot about the rest of the world. It's next to Paul Revere Road. Anyhow, I'm at church on a Sunday morning and I meet a young man. His name is Isaac Oyibo. Now, I had traveled enough to realize that was not necessarily a local name. And I said to him, Isaac, I said, where are you from? He says, I'm from Nigeria. I said, wonderful. I said, are you an international student in the area? Boston has a lot of international students. No. I said, are you here with one of the companies getting some training? No. I said, Isaac, what brings you to Boston then? He says, I am a missionary from my church in Nigeria. We have sent missionaries to Boston because we heard you need the gospel here. And I said, well, you welcome, right? And then he says, we have seen your movies. We know your country needs missionaries. It's a great transition. You know, Urbana, my first Urbana was 1973. Since Urbana 73, I've been to commission in Nairobi, Kenya, where 1,500 Kenyan students are contemplating God's call into missions. I've been to an Urbana-type conference in Sri Lanka. I've been to an Urbana-type conference in Indonesia, into Taiwan, 4 times to Nigeria, where these young people are just zealously evaluating where God wants them in the world. People like you. in their student lives, asking God where He wants them to go. And when I talk about the great transition, you need to realize the largest church in Europe is pastored by a Nigerian missionary to Kiev, Ukraine. The largest church in London is pastored by a Nigerian, and one of the five largest churches in New York City is pastored by a Nigerian. And you see missionaries from China and Nigeria and Brazil and India and Korea especially to the ends of the earth, because we're all part of that commandment from Jesus to go and preach the gospel, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the ends of the earth. And as one of my friends from Fiji said, your Jerusalem is my ends of the earth. And he said, we are the ends of the earth from Jerusalem. So my Jerusalem is the ends of the earth. You know, in other words, he's going, the world is seeing the gospel as their responsibility from every nation to every nation. Dr. Mark Knoll of Notre Dame has written a new book just out this year called The New Shape of World Christianity. And a lot of it's about this great transition going on. And he says this to sort of dramatize his point at the very beginning of the book. He said, this past Sunday, it's possible that more Christian believers attended church in China than in all of so-called Christian Europe. Yet in 1970, there were no legally functioning churches in all of China, and only in 71 did the Chinese government allow for one Protestant and one Catholic church. But now, some people estimate there might be 100 million Christians in China. And they're preparing to send missionaries, you saw it on the video last night, back to Jerusalem, across the Buddhist, Hindu, and Muslim world to complete the cycle of taking the gospel around the world. He said, this past Sunday, more Anglicans attended church in each of the countries of Kenya, South Africa, Tanzania, and Uganda than Anglicans attended church in Britain, Canada, and all of the Episcopalians in the United States combined. And Nigeria had four times as many Anglicans as those other countries. He goes on to say, this past Sunday, there were more Presbyterians at church in Ghana than in Scotland, where Presbyterianism sort of came from. This past Sunday, there were more members of the Brazil Pentecostal Assemblies of God Church at church than the combined total in the two largest Pentecostal denominations in the United States. And most telltale is this statement. This past week in Great Britain, at least 15,000 Christian foreign missionaries were hard at work evangelizing the locals. Most of these missionaries are from Africa and Asia. I was in Germany on my way to a conference we were having in St. Petersburg, so we had a day layover, and you know, when you get jet lag, you try to stay up during the day, so I was walking around town just trying to keep awake and not fall asleep, and as I'm walking, it's a Friday afternoon, everybody's out of work, and I could hear the cadence in the distance of preaching, and I just knew this was somebody street preaching. They're preaching the gospel, right? I mean, it was in German, but I still could, you know, understand what he was doing. I turn the corner, and there's hundreds of Germans, descendants of Martin Luther, founder of the Reformation. Hundreds of Germans sitting in the city square, drinking their steins of beer, having their bread or their after dinner, snacks and everything. And there's a guy preaching his heart out, and other people handing out tracts. The preacher was from Angola, preaching in German to the descendants of Martin Luther. That's the great transition I'm talking about, from every nation to every nation. The second great is what we'll hear about tonight. It's simply called, in my words, the Great Migration. The Great Migration has to do with the vast movement of peoples, legally and illegally, documented and undocumented, not just into the United States and Canada, but all across Europe and in various parts of Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. The Great Migration. You know, the country of the Philippines, when you go through customs, there's three lines. There's visitors, there's citizens or residents, and then there's OFWs, Overseas Filipino Workers. They estimate that more than 10% of the nation of the Philippines is working in some other country of the world. A couple of years ago, we got to visit down in the Caribbean to the Cayman Islands. Now, some of you are saying, here I am, Lord, send me. You know, we got to visit to the Cayman Islands. Every person checking us out at the supermarket was from the Philippines. Now, the point is this. With the migrations of peoples, you might have opportunity to reach people that were up to this point considered unreached, but not because you went to their place, but because they came to your place. Open your eyes. The world is changing in our face. Yesterday, coming from the airport, we actually had a group of us, so we took a taxi. The guy driving us is a Sudanese Muslim from Central Sudan. And I have no idea if he's ever heard the gospel. But he's right here. I could not get to Central Sudan to do the gospel, and I couldn't do it in Arabic. But he speaks English now. The Great Migration, that's the world that we're living in. Earlier this month, in December, I was visiting with a friend of mine in Cairo, Egypt. He's an Egyptian citizen, but he has served many years as a teacher in Libya. He was exiled or recently deported from Libya, and he was really wondering, what does God want from me next? Because I just love the people from Libya, he said. And we started talking about the fact of God's calling him not to Libya, but to Libyans. And I told him, I said, you speak Spanish already? He said, yeah. I said, Havana, Cuba, that's God's next call for you. He said, why do you say that? I said, because years ago, Muammar Gaddafi and Fidel Castro had friendship. Now there's hundreds of Tripoli Libya students in Havana, reachable for the gospel. Open your eyes. In my own community, we found out that in two towns over, there's 12,000 Moroccan Muslims. That's the migrations I'm talking about. And, it has all sorts of ramifications. For some of you, like Ramez Atala, you might want to become a social worker. Helping people get resettled. I met a lady after the first workshop. She had come here in 2000 through a ministry that I'm associated with called World Relief. She was resettled as a refugee from Somalia. In the last 9 years, she's become a follower of Jesus. And now she's going back. I mean, that's what it's about. From every nation to every nation, back to every nation. And the grand migration of peoples is providing new opportunities. Two quick stories. I live in Boston, so I'm very close to Lesley College, and I was visiting some friends. Actually, they're here at Urbana. They now work in Beijing. But I was visiting some friends, and they said, we know that you have for maybe, 20 years been praying for the little Hindu country of, Tibetan Buddhist country of Bhutan. Everybody know where Bhutan is? No, you don't. It's up in the Himalayas, totally locked in Tibetan Buddhism, very isolated from most of the world. And they said, we know you've been praying for Bhutan. We want you to meet one of our students. So they took me over before we went for dinner. They said, this is a student. She's a sophomore here. Her name is Chimmy Wangchuck. Now, if I had prayed more intelligently for the leaders of Bhutan, I might have recognized the name. But we sat down later, and they said, Chimmy is the favorite daughter of the favorite wife of the king of Bhutan. So the princess of Bhutan was studying 10 miles from my house. You start praying for things, and God will start bringing people into your midst. I was in a church in Pennsylvania, and they're right on a college campus, and they have a welcome dinner every September for international students. And I was supposed to be the welcome rah-rah guy, welcome to America, this kind of thing. And it was free food, so a lot of the students would come. This church also has a vision for praying for an unreached people group. Does everybody know what I mean by that? It's like an ethnic-specific group that has no witness of the gospel or no what's called reproducing church. It can't stand on its own. So this church had adopted this people group from South China called the Miao people, M-I-A-O. And all over the church were these little posters, pray for the Miao, pray for the Miao. And it had statistics about their people group, how many there were, how many known Christians, where they were located, is there any church, what missionaries are working with this people. So you'd have all this data, and you'd pray for those things. So everybody in the church was supposed to be praying for the Miao people. So I'm standing outside the banquet hall, and a young man comes up to me, and I'm looking at him, and I'm guessing he's from China. And he said, excuse me, sir, are you from this church? I said, no, I'm not from this church. This is my first time in this church. He said, me too. This is my first time in this church, first time in any church. I am from People's Republic of China. I am a master's student. I am just starting, but I heard there was food. So I came. So, it's a good evangelistic tool, food. And I said, well, you are welcome. He says, I need to ask a question, though. I said, what's your question? He goes, what is this sign? And he points to the sign, pray for the Miao. And I tried the best I could to a guy who's obviously unchurched and has no idea. I said, well, these people are followers of Jesus, and they're trying to have other people know about the love of Jesus, so they've invited, they've invited their church to pray for this ethnic group from South China. He goes, it is amazing. I said, why? You get all excited. It's amazing. I said, what? What's amazing is, I am Meow. These are my people. I said, this church has been praying for you. You know, because God's at work. And when the peoples of the world are migrating into your neighborhood, don't look at it as an imposition. It's an invitation from God. The migrations of people. And some of you, if you're a pre-law or law student, let me just encourage you. We desperately need followers of Jesus who are going to specialize in immigration law. Because I believe in the next few years, there's going to be a window of opportunity for every undocumented person in the United States, at least, to get their documentation in order. And I don't think they're going to go to the government to do it. As a matter of fact, one fellow was challenging us. He said that the churches need to open up immigration resettlement centers to be the ones who help advocate with the legal processing of these people so they don't get deported unnecessarily. You know, and so it's really a challenging thing to think about this great migration from all sorts of angles. You know, you could start at your own church in English as a second language program, and you could end up having a whole bunch of Moroccan Muslims coming in there just to learn English. And you could never go and preach the gospel freely in Morocco, but you can invite these people to your house for Easter and explain what it means to you. The great migration. The third challenge, or the third issue facing around the world, is simply what I would call the great divide. The great divide. Now, later on, I'll sort of allude to this again, but I'm going to give you four different divides, at least from my point of view. First of all, the most conspicuous divide is the divide between the rich and the poor. That gets a fairly heavy emphasis here at Urbana, but you need to know that those of us in this room are still in the top 10% of the world's wealthiest people. So 90% of the world doesn't live like we live. And so there's something wrong. And really, when you think about it, if most of the Christian church now is in the majority world, most of our Christian brothers and sisters are economically less advantaged than we are. And what does that mean for us? How can we use our generosity without creating dependency? All sorts of questions for another workshop. But the reality is the rich and poor gap is not being always narrowed by globalization. Sometimes Americans especially very simplistically say, well, yeah, but all these people, they're working in call centers in India. If you've read Thomas Friedman, he tends to present an India that's what I simply call a big, shiny call center. All right? And in reality, even if 300 million Indians are working in middle-class jobs, that could still leave 700 or 800 million Indians who are suffering in poverty. Because India is just vast. So the rich-poor divide. It calls us to think about things like caring for the poor, justice issues. It calls us to wrestle with issues like microfinance and business as mission and those kind of things. The East and the West is also another divide, still under point three. Dividing in terms of theology. Mark Knoll again in this book, he says, here are the questions that the global church is asking that the Western church doesn't usually ask. How close is the world of spirits to everyday life? Or if you're from Asian backgrounds, where is the world of the ancestors play in my world? Or from African backgrounds too. Or how does the Holy Spirit's power manifest itself? How many of you are cessationist? Anybody know what a cessationist is? It's a theological word used. It's actually used to describe people who believe that the miracle signs and wonder gifts have ceased in the first century. That's the word cessation. All right. So in other words, you don't believe in healing, miracle healing. You don't believe in people raised from the dead, visions, signs, wonders, and dreams, all that kind of stuff. That's a cessationist. It's a very commonly held position in a lot of American traditional churches. Here's my point. If you want to be a cessationist, don't travel. Because the church in the majority world did not get the memo. All right? So when somebody gets sick, the first thing they do is pray and anoint them with oil. If somebody falls out the third floor window, they don't dial 911. They say, what did they do in the book of Acts? All right? First time I was in Nigeria, they give you a young man to carry your bag, and I thought I was getting ripped off. He comes, just tears out of my hand. I said, give me that. You know, but he actually was just to carry my bag. And so finally we got to be friends, and I said to him, let's call him Robert. I said, Robert, how did you become a Christian? He said, oh, Brother John over there raised me from the dead. You know? And I said to him, I said, so my testimony about becoming a Christian on the youth retreat is kind of lame. You know? Now, my wife, who's a medical person, you know what she says? Do you think he was really dead? No, I said he was just mostly dead, like Princess Bride, you know. I said, maybe he was in a coma, but whatever it was, he popped back up again, all right? You know, and I asked some of my Nigerian friends, why do they see more miracles? You know what he said? You have more doctors. If God doesn't heal us, we die. You know, the church that's dependent upon Jesus sees the power in a way that the church that's dependent on themselves doesn't. And we have a lot to learn about dependency. Now, you know, and he actually said you have more doctors. And he said good theology. He said God heals you one way, he heals us another. So he's not saying don't go to the emergency ward. He's saying if you've got it, go there. But if you don't have it, then pray. And pray for the book of Acts God, the Holy Spirit power God. And the East has that kind of mentality, or Africa, Asia, Latin America has more of that mentality than, say, the conservative, thought-provoking people at Harvard University near the neighborhood where I live. And even in theology, some of you who are attuned to what's happening in the Anglican Church or the Episcopal Church, you realize how many Episcopal churches are aligning themselves now. Conservative, biblical Episcopal churches are aligning themselves now with bishops from Uganda, Rwanda, Nigeria, because they want to stay true to the Scriptures, and they believe the American evangelical Episcopal movement has moved away from that. You also have in our world, in terms of the Great Divide, the West versus the rest. That's the title of a book that you can find in the bookstore, Why the Rest Hates the West. And the reality is, brothers and sisters, not every country in the world loves America. Canada, they love a little bit more, because they don't know. But not every country in the world loves America. And so as Christians, your first citizenship, you have to remind yourself that first and foremost, my passport is in heaven. I'm first and foremost a citizen of heaven. Use your American or Canadian passport to get to where God wants you, just like Paul used his Roman citizenship. But realize the fact that sometimes in some countries, you're going to have to prove yourself because they've been trained to feel alienated against the Western world that we represent. And then finally, you still have in our world the great divides of ethnic hostilities, both in our own country and around the world. If you ask Pastor Oscar, he will tell you how, Pastor Oscar speaks tomorrow night, you ask him how the Kenyan church was so humbled when after 2007 elections there was inter-ethnic violence between Christians. Because suddenly they realized that that great ethnic divide that they thought they had healed has not been healed. And if I could speak as an American, I've heard Americans say, well, you know, now that we have an African-American president, racism's over. Brothers and sisters, that's an overly simplistic view of the world. There's a lot of work yet to be done. And we need Christians who are going to be involved in the world as peacemakers, as reconcilers, as bridge-building people. So the great divides are challenges enough. But you know, when you think about these divides, I was reminded of a story a few years ago told by Reverend Dr. Zach Nieringhia. He was the Bible expositor here at Urbana, and he's now the assistant bishop of Kampala Diocese in Uganda. And so he's high up there. And I was asking about Uganda. Because you might not know this, but Uganda was at one point the only country that had reversed the trend about HIV/AIDS cases. And they were actually reversing it. And I asked him, I said, what was the secret? He said the secret was when the church owned the problem for themselves. And when he said it this way, he says, when we began to say to ourselves, not people have AIDS, not sinners have AIDS, but we began to say to ourselves, my family has AIDS. That's when I got involved, he said. That's when we got involved. And so when I challenge you this, is the church around the world in 60 Minutes, You know, ask yourself the question, what struggles is my family facing? My family in the Middle East and religious persecution. My family in places like Chad with economic depravity. What challenges is my family facing in places like Sri Lanka or India? And we'll get to that in just a minute. The fourth challenge, I'm using the next two, 4 and 5, are both visual images to represent something bigger. But the fourth challenge is simply, I call it the Great Wall. Now, the Great Wall obviously implies, first of all, the great, great challenge in the world of China. China is going to be, you know, the largest superpower that will shape the force of your lives. Economically and otherwise, China is there and big. And basically, the China Wall, though, how many of you have ever been to China and seen the Great Wall? All right. Supposedly, it's the only human-erected thing that you can see from the moon. I've never been to the moon, so I wouldn't know. But it is huge, it's immense, it's impressive, and it represents a huge desire of people to separate themselves from each other. There are long stretches of wall that go no particular place. And a lot of the walls goes up and down mountains like this. I was actually on top of the wall, and I said to my wife, if you could get up this hill, what's the extra 12 feet? You know, I mean, it's like, didn't seem sensical to me. But anyhow, they weren't asking me when they built it. But the Great Wall, it indicates not only the challenge of China, which represents not only one of the fastest growing churches, but also the country with the highest number of unreached peoples. How's that? Because when you have 1.3 billion people, you can have the best of everything. And let me just pause here for a moment. If you have a Chinese heritage, brothers and sisters, let me just exhort you to look at that like Paul's Roman citizenship. If you speak Mandarin, if you have a double passport, whatever it is, there are opportunities there. And I know one of the challenges is, you know, your parents are going to say, we didn't get you out of there to get you back there. You know, but the reality is there's opportunities there that are opening up and will open up that, you know, a country that was hidden from the world for all of my growing up. All right, in 1973, there was not one chance for any Westerner to go to China. And now all of a sudden, there's doors flung open for English teachers and business people, etc. The Great Wall, though, also represents the divide between peoples, the unreached peoples. You might not have seen it in the video last night, but there was a statistic that said there are still 2 billion people, or one-third of the world, that has had no legitimate witness to Jesus Christ. I'm not talking about they've rejected Jesus. I'm saying they never heard who Jesus is. That would be a wall between us and them that has to be climbed over to get to them, if you will. And the Great Wall also exists between world religions. One of your applications at Urbana might be to take a course on understanding other world religions, because the world religions, like the migrations of peoples, are also going all over the world. And the radical fringe elements of religious extremism is creating one of the greatest challenges for your brothers and sisters around the world in places like Indonesia, in Sri Lanka, across the Middle East, and of course, even in India. I get a bulletin every week from a group called Compass Direct, and it's basically recording incidences of Christian persecution of Christians, or religious persecution. And the country that appears most every month on religious persecution is actually India. Because there's a radical Hindu group that wants to Hinduize India and causes great havoc for the Christians there. But I go every 2 years to Sri Lanka. And in Sri Lanka, radical Buddhists are trying to make that country into a totally Buddhist regime. Now you might say, wait a second, I took a course in world religions. Radical Buddhists is like an oxymoron, you know? But not in Sri Lanka. Before the tsunami in 2004, on a weekly or monthly basis, radical Buddhists were burning down Christian churches in Sri Lanka. You know, so whatever the Buddha taught about peaceful living, they didn't read that chapter. You know, because they've exchanged Buddhism for nationalism. And that's part of the Great Wall. Number 5 will be represented well here at Urbana. I simply call it the Great Barrier Reef. And the Great Barrier Reef actually is visible from the moon because it's the largest, you know, structure underwater. Everybody know where it is? Off the coast of Australia. You know, Crocodile Hunter. He went swimming there. Don't do that. But the Great Barrier represents what I just simply would call the great issue of the environment. Because whether or not everything about the environment is true or not true, we need Christians to be involved in helping, because basically when the environment gets destroyed faster, the poorest people suffer worst. When the land becomes barren, the rich people move to another place, the poor people get to farm there. And it calls us to think about the reality of our environment. Whether or not it's just a normal shift or a cataclysmic shift, I'm not going to try to argue that. But there's plenty of opportunities here. On the 30th, you'll actually hear from people dedicating their Christian lives to environmental issues. And that's my way of saying that when it comes to the great divides between peoples, some of you need to become reconciling missionaries. And some of you, God's going to call you to go into the State Department and work for peace between nations. My dream is that out of Urbana someday will come a UN General Secretary that will take gospel values into this vast conclave of countries. You know, and the same thing with the environment. We need to see people go out from Urbana who are dedicated to being church planters in the Middle East, and other people who are dedicated to being tree planters in eroded areas. Because it's all part of God's work in redeeming people and the world. In Sri Lanka, when the tsunami came in 2004, it's pretty well defended that the people that suffered the most were the poorest people. So the environment is not just an environmental issue, it's a rich-poor issue. And as I like to tell people, if the environmental issue goes as haywire as some predict it will, there will be no other issues. You understand that? Because if like the environment ceases to exist, all other issues are done. Because the world's over. You're college students, you knew that, right? You know, okay, why don't you? Number six. This is the next two are biblical ones. The Great Commission. The Great Commission. In my church, there was a young guy who was a brand new Christian, no Christian background at all, and I was talking to him one time. I asked him, I said, what do you think is the Great Commission? He looked at me kind of like deer in the headlights, glazed looks. Well, I'd have to say 30%. Now see, some of you are so Christian you don't even get the joke. The guy's background was sales. He was a brand new Christian. What's the Great Commission? He said 10% would be good, 20% better, 30%, that's a Great Commission. What's the Great Commission? Generally speaking, it's the passage in Matthew chapter 28 where Jesus says to the disciples, all authority is given to me in heaven and on earth. Go and make disciples of all the nations, teaching them to observe everything I've commanded you, and I'm with you always to the end of the age. All right? That's the Great Commission. And the reason I bring it up in terms of the church around the world or the issues around the world is that we've done a great job with the Great Commission of making converts. We have not done a great job of making disciples. You understand the difference? The person who raises their hand at the end of a presentation might be a convert, but might not be a disciple. Jesus didn't say, go into all the world and make converts. He said, go into all the world and make disciples. And if you work on campus in any kind of discipleship ministry, you know that making a disciple is tough work. You got to dig deep into the person's life. You got to dig deep in your own life. And you got to see a lot of things remade. It takes time. Converts can be pretty fast. Disciples can take a lifetime. But in the Great Commission, Jesus reminds us that the issue is not to make the church broader, but deeper. Around the world, leaders will say to me, even in the United States, the greatest problem here is that the church is miles wide and inches deep. Nominal Christians who aren't integrating the Christian life into the way they live, into the way they treat their spouses, into the way they treat the community, in the way they do business, in the way they do politics. We need disciples. And when you think about the Great Commission, and you think about your part in the Great Commission, four things to remember. This is still subpoint number under six. Number one, Jesus stands up in front of his disciples and says, all authority. Now this is a post-resurrection appearance of Jesus, so I like to remind people, when Jesus stood in front of his disciples, if he had his hands out like this and he said, all authority is given to me in heaven and on earth, the light was shining through the holes in his hands. In other words, he's saying, folks, I've just conquered death. All authority is mine. Parenthesis, you don't need to go into the world afraid about being people who adhere to absolute truth. I've conquered death to tell you that I'm the truth. You don't have to be afraid of how you're going to get treated. All authority belongs to me. Nothing's going to happen to you that I'm not going to allow. All authority. When we go out into the world, we go in His authority. In His authority. Second thing is, it says all nations. If you've taken any kind of mission course like Perspectives, you know that this means not just all the geopolitical units, but also all the ethnic specific units. So not just China, but China and the Han people and the Miao people and all the other people. So all the ethnicities of the world. So if we're looking for opportunities to evangelize, we need to be thinking not just about nations, but about the specific people from those nations. Third thing he says, all things, teaching them to observe all things. Not just the happy things, not just the user-friendly, seeker-friendly, I feel fulfilled with Jesus things, but things like the cross, taking up the cross daily, laying down your life, putting other people first, the uncomfortable things, the things that might not make you smile. But the reality is, wherever you're going, he says, I am with you always. So four superlatives. I have all authority to send you to all nations, to teach all the things that I've commanded you. And brothers and sisters, if you didn't get it the first time, I'm with you always. How many of you think about what God might call you to when you get afraid? You think about where God might call you in the world, you get afraid. All right, let me put it another way. How many, if I said to you, God might call you to stay single, would be afraid? Okay, let's just concentrate on that one. All right. What's the most common command in the Bible? Nigerian guy told me this. Don't be afraid. Now what that means is, it doesn't mean you'll never be afraid. Trust me on that one. It means don't be ruled by your fears. Don't be ruled by your fears. You know, in the Psalms it says, when I am afraid, I will trust in you. You will be afraid. You will arrive someplace on a short-term, long-term mission trip and you'll say to yourself, what have I done? Why am I here? You know? I've been in many places where I've been waiting at the airport. No one's coming to pick me up. And I say, Jesus, I'm giving you the 7:30 and then I'm really going to freak out. You know? And more than a few times they show up at like 7:29. I mean, but the reality is, people ask me, have you ever been afraid? Yeah. It's like you'd be stupid not to be afraid. You know, I remember one time right after 9/11, my wife and I were teaching over in Sri Lanka. We were flying home, and it was a Friday, and there was a man on the plane with his dress and everything. You knew he was a Muslim. And during one of the moments of, you know, seatbelts unfastened, he was up praying, you know, in the aisle, right? And we're watching. If you can talk about this being anachronistic, we're sitting in this Singapore Airlines jet flying to whatever place next, watching Dr. Doolittle 2 with Eddie Murphy, all right? And my wife suddenly goes, my hand, where's the Muslim guy? You know, because at that point we were thinking about the Muslim is rushing the cockpit. You know, this is after 9/11. And, you know, and turned out he had slouched down in his seat and he was sound asleep. So, you know, fear doesn't have to have facts. You can just be afraid. Right? I like to make up things to be afraid of. It's funny, I can go to Afghanistan and not be afraid, but be terrified of losing my suitcase on the way home from Urbana. I mean, it doesn't sound logic. But Jesus goes with you everywhere. Jesus doesn't dwell exclusively in North America. When you go to some dangerous spot, He's there with you in His authority, giving you presence of His presence with you, always. Related to the Great Commission, though, my friend Peter Kuzmich from Gordon Conwell Seminary says it this way. We need to preach out of Matthew, not just the Great Commission, but in terms of the church around the world, we need to preach the Great Compassion. That's point number seven. Great Compassion. In other words, Jesus says, teaching them to observe all things. Well, only a few chapters earlier, Matthew 25, he's told them what some of those things are. You know, the way you treat the poor, the way you treat the marginalized, the way you treat the hungry and the naked and the prisoner and the homeless, the people needing justice is part of your mission, our mission. And one of the challenges of the church around the world is not just to proclaim Jesus, a la the Great Commission, but to proclaim Jesus by our deed as well. So there's no room for basically a one-sided gospel. We preach Jesus by our words and by our deeds. We preach Jesus by teaching in English as a second language class and loving people and helping them understand how to manage food stamps. You know, we preach Jesus in all accounts. And this is especially significant because for many of us, similar to, if you go to the World Vision exhibit, they talk about basically acts of justice, you know, that you choose to do. Tomorrow in my workshop, I'll talk a little bit about being intentional about things. And how do we as Christians be more intentional? Now, I'm a pretty basic person, being formerly a youth worker. I look for any way I can to connect your life, my life, to God's world. So a few years ago, it kind of dawned on me. This is my only creative idea I've ever had. Are you ready for this? The only creative idea. I encourage people to pray for the country on the label of their clothes. All right, so turn to your neighbor and find out what countries are on your back today. I'm not talking about made in the gap, although Ezekiel says stand in the gap. I'm talking about made in. Okay, a little audience response here. Stand up if your wardrobe, not yourself, stand up if your wardrobe is from China. All right, I commission you to the 1.3 billion people that made your clothes, all right? Sit down. How many people have Indonesia? All right. Next, sit down. India. Right. How about any place Southeast Asia, by which I mean Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, and I'll include Sri Lanka in there. Now, I don't know if you're thinking you may be seated. And just for a short of a dramatic thing, it worked in the first, may not work here. How many of you had the USA? All right, now stay standing for a moment. For those of you who are seated or standing, just look around. How many people aren't standing? In other words, the world is in our closets, right? I thought about doing a seminar one time, and I was going to use the phrase out of the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus says, when you pray, go into your closet, all right? So, I personally think that's a command to respond to globalization, not really. But I have a friend in Sri Lanka. He's a member of IFES, the International Fellowship of Evangelical Students. He's a wonderful man, brilliant man. His books are in the bookstore. And he is fond of telling me a lot of the things that are wrong with the United States. So when I go to visit him, I got to fasten my seatbelt and just listen to it. But I told him, I said, you know, when I speak to students in America, oftentimes what I do is I encourage them to start their vision for the world by praying for the country on the label of their clothes. I said, but I've been to sweatshops here in Sri Lanka. My question to you, when I speak to Western audiences, should I tell those students to boycott those places where they get those clothes from? And I expected to get a full octane blast against, you know, Americanization, globalization, you're corrupting the world, that kind of thing. He said very soberly, he said, no. If they boycott those clothes, poor people will get poorer. The factory might close. And people that were getting, you know, pennies in a sweatshop will now resort to have something else, maybe worse, even prostitution if they had to. I said, what should I tell my students then? He said, tell the students, especially your business majors, to become executives for Nike and all of the multinational corporations that run these factories. Because they can bring Christian influence of compassion and justice and mercy into that environment. He said they can make rules of how the factory workers are treated that could change a whole village. So I shared that with a church in New York City, And this one fellow came to me, he says, that's a great idea. He says, I'm a buyer. I'm the representative buyer to a factory we have in Madagascar, that island off of eastern Africa. He said, he says, I buy jeans from them. I said, okay. He says, I sell them on Fifth Avenue. We buy them for a dollar and sell them for $400. And he said, maybe we can, you know, do something. So he ended up faxing the factory and saying, how much would it cost if you improved the, paid for the school fees, you have to understand other world's governments the way that it is, pay for the school fees of all the children, pay for better housing and sanitation for the workers, and paid for more reasonable hours so you'd have more workers. How much would that cost? And he sort of laid it out a little bit. And the guy got a message back, he told me this later on. He said, it would jump the price, it would quadruple the price from the factory. $4. All right. So they made the sacrifice to go from a $399 profit down to a $396 profit on the jeans. Just by a Christian doing something with his position of power. You know? And he actually faxed them back. He says, do that. We'll send you the extra money. We'll do the extra things. If you don't do it, we won't honor the contract. You know, he was leveraging for the poor. See, compassion is going to take different shapes. Some of you might go live with Shane Claiborne in a simple community. Others of you might want to become legal aides that can influence a senator to make a decision that will empower many poor people. Who knows? But we need to think in terms of eyes of compassion towards our world. And it's one of the biggest challenges facing the church. Number 8. I'll review all 9 of them for those of you who are list maniacs. Number 8 is what I simply call the great salvation. It's my way of saying, and it applies to a lot of us, including myself, in any place in the world where the Christian church is more than 2 or 3 generations old, Christianity can become quickly nominal. And I use this phrase, great salvation, out of the scriptures where it says, how shall we escape if we neglect this great salvation? And my challenge to you, brothers and sisters, and to myself, is to remember the greatness of salvation that's in Jesus Christ. Don't lose the wonder of what Jesus has done for us. Because the American lifestyle is so incredibly enticing that it's way more desirous to desire the American lifestyle than it is sometimes to desire the Jesus lifestyle. Especially if you take salvation for granted. But you know, one of the most famous missionaries of the 19th century, a man named C.T. Studd, his most famous quotation was, if Jesus Christ is God and he died for me, no sacrifice I make is too great. If you say, I want to follow Jesus, you say, Jesus, in light of everything you've done for me, here I am. I'm responding. If you know the story of Isaiah 6, he's responding to forgiveness. And my exhortation to me and to you is, don't neglect salvation. Everything we're doing is because Jesus picked us up. Jesus moved into my neighborhood. Jesus became flesh to me, for me, and laid down his life. And that's my way of telling you that if you follow Jesus to the ends of the earth, and I will say this, and I'm not meant to be dramatic or prophetic. I always think about this at Urbana. Some of you will follow Jesus to the ends of the earth and have a premature entry into heaven. Meaning you won't live out the normal American dream. You won't get to retire to Phoenix and play golf and be the tennis champion in your retirement home. You know, you won't live out that dream because you went where Jesus took you. And that's my way, just a segue for a moment, a transition off topic. Some people will say to me, Paul, the safest place to be is in the center of God's will. How many believe that? Safest place to be. All right, let me contradict you for a moment. Who is the ultimate person who was in the center of God's will? Jesus. If you as long as you just define Calvary and the Holy Week and the cross as safety, then yes, the safest place to be is in the safe place center of God's will. Because in the center of God's will, he may evangelize the people you want to reach by you laying down your life. I was just in Ghana in October, and my host, all Ghanaians, took me to the missionary cemetery, where vast numbers of 25 and 26-year-olds had died within 2 years of coming to Ghana, or West Africa at the time, to bring the gospel. If you know the story, the British missionaries, when they came to West Africa, packed their own earthly belongings in their own caskets, because they knew when they brought the gospel they were going to die there. And they did. You know, and the tombs, you know, they were, you know, in Ghana from 1825 to 1827. I mean, it just gives you these dates. And you realize they didn't last long. But they planted the seed of the gospel, and I visited a Pentecostal church in Ghana that's sending missionaries from Ghana to 70 different countries in the world. Because someone laid down their lives. And so, when you start thinking about the great salvation, realize you're identified with the man who laid down his life so that someone else might benefit. Unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies. And you know, for most of us, following Jesus in this world is not necessarily going to be literally dying. But it might be downsizing our lifestyle. It might be taking vacation time to go on a short-term mission trip when we could be just relaxing. It might be coming to Urbana rather than having Christmas time, right? But it's all a little bit about identifying with Jesus and saying, you know, in light of your great salvation, Jesus, I want to go where you're going. I want to go where you're going. Number nine, though. I'm going to call it the Great Celebration. And I use this term because I want you to realize that in the church around the world, as we go around in these 60 minutes, it's not all about challenges. It's about celebrating. Colossians 1:6 is one of my theme verses. All over the world, the gospel is bearing fruit and growing. I started praying for Bhutan, I told you that. And last February, I had the privilege of teaching a course in northeast India, in what's called Guwahati, part of Assam state. And they said, we want you to meet Nima. We know you have prayed for Bhutan. And Nima's my class, my student. The first Bhutanese Christian I've ever met. And I was reminded of Revelation 5:9-7:9, where it says there's going to be a great celebration someday where people from every tribe and tongue and nation are going to be worshiping Jesus. That Bangladesh guy that made your shirt because you prayed for him, maybe got into a correspondence course, became a follower of Jesus, and you're going to meet him at that celebration. Wouldn't that be awesome? My name is Abdul Abdullah. I made your shirt. You know? I mean, you know, but God works that way. We're part of something bigger. My way, I want to just let you know, when you go out into all the world, you might suffer and you might incur hardship, but you're part of God's winning team. You're part of God's winning team. God is going to bring a day when Urbana will be multiplied by hundreds of people groups and languages and will understand each other and will be singing praise to the Lamb because we're all redeemed by His precious blood. Read those verses. That'll keep you going. When you're struggling to reach out to that Muslim student on your campus, you're struggling to reach out with some Buddhist guy at the Thai restaurant, and you say, I'm not making any headway at all. Remember, there's a day coming when people from every tribe and tongue and nation are going to be worshiping Jesus. And we have the privilege of enlarging that worship service through our lives. Let me review the 9 points. Then I'll take a few minutes of questions and I'll dismiss you a little bit early in the interest of supper, although I don't know whether you're a diamond, triangle, or whatever that is, trapezoid, whatever. All right, so here we go. Here are the 9 points to review. Ready? And number one was the Great Transition, where basically Christianity has moved from the northern hemisphere to the south, the east to the west, the west to the east. The second was the Great Migration, which again you'll hear more about tonight. The movement of peoples for all sorts of reasons, ranging from political to economic, and the opportunities that will present us with compassion as well as discipleship and evangelism. The Great Divide, that's the rich-poor theological conflicts, West versus the rest, ethnic divides. Number four was the Great Wall, symbolizing the separation of people from each other. Number five was the Great Barrier Reef, symbolic of the environmental challenges. Number six, the Great Commission, to make not only converts, to make disciples. The Great Compassion, to demonstrate the gospel, not just preach it. the great salvation, our motivation for everything is because of what Jesus has done for us, and the great celebration of the day coming when every tribe, tongue, and nation are worshiping Jesus. I'm going to take the microphone, go down here, and in the interest of time, I'm going to tell you that we'll take questions. Oh, my watch is back up here. We'll take questions for about 5 to 7 minutes. And if you have other questions after that, in other words, I'll be dismissing us at 5:15. How's that? Although some are already leaving. Any burning questions? If you want, I can end it even earlier. So raise your hand if you want me to end it earlier. You guys don't make any decisions. What's the deal here? All right, questions then. Right here. So we have a couple of mics, I think. One.
Thank you. My question is, I'm from the University of Waterloo in Canada, and I took an evil course. Mm. And one of the problems about, I guess, corporations is that even if you had a Christian background, your role as a CEO is to provide the greatest profit for your shareholders. So what is a Christian to do about that? Because if you for example, you were to either ship wheat to either Russia or to a poor country, you as a CEO has a responsibility to ship it to Russia instead of a poor country, because you'll get a higher profit from that. So as a Christian, what can you do about that?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I'm honestly not really equipped to answer it, to be honest with you. I'm being candid. As my wife said, you've never had a real job. I have never, because it's easier to theorize about it. My biggest suggestion would be there is a lot of seminars here on business as mission, and there's a great book called Great Commission Companies, which I think is in the bookstore. And his basic idea is create companies that create profit so that, when you go overseas, those countries will want you to stay there because you have so many jobs. In terms of the Western world, it's indeed a bigger challenge. But I think sometimes Christians, have to realize that one of the weakest things of individualistic Christianity in the Western world is that we really don't know how to speak into systemic evil. We know how to speak to individual evil, but not into systems of evil. And I think unless we make some slow changes, and I think that would be probably my biggest answer, is that over time, I think you can, rather than either or proposition, you can move in a certain direction. Studying, it's not business, but politics, but studying the life of William Wilberforce, over I forget what it was, a 35-year period, he changed their law system to be morally outraged about slavery. I think over a long period of time, a CEO could move a company in a certain direction. That would be my hope, but I'm not really qualified to answer it. All right, another question. Sir?
Yes, I'm curious, from all your experiences, where do you feel like God is moving most, in which countries?
Oh, wow. Yeah, the question was, where do I feel God's moving most and in which countries? There are powerful things happening in many, many places. And in one sense, the very fact that I get to go there probably indicates something's happening. I will say this. There's very seldom a place I've ever been where it's uniformly going forward. And see, that's one thing that we don't like. We want to have it being, where's the revival happening? Well, the revival is happening. For example, Nigeria could easily become second only to Korea as the greatest missionary sending country in the world. But Nigeria is also having fights with Islam from the north because of Sharia law states. So it's both and. And so I defer to a famous historian by the name of Andrew Walls, where he says basically the church grows in sort of cycles of success, failure, success, failure, success, failure. And sometimes you actually see it happen simultaneously. If you ask me right now, a country that I'm potentially most excited about, I would probably say just by virtue of the sheer grassroots fire of the gospel, probably would be China. There's just some amazing things happening there and things that are making it into the news. I just can't wait to heaven. You get your Urbana today in heaven, and it's going to have all this news that you never read. You know, I talked in the earlier session about some guys telling me about one particular village in a North African country where the people who are of Berber descent, that would be the, they were Christians before they were Islamized by the Arab invaders, the whole village seeing visions of Jesus and then turning to Jesus. You know, and there are stories coming out of the Middle East that if we printed them, you know, that story, the phone number story that he told, I had heard that when I was in Cairo. I mean, it's just amazing. Almost every Muslim that becomes a follower of Jesus, there's a vision involved, a miracle involved. You know, Jesus shows up at their house. And if you have, I actually want to say this, if you have Muslim friends at your school, pray that they'll have visions of Jesus or angels. Angels are okay too. There's a huge regard for angels in Islam, because that's how Muhammad got dictated the Quran, you know. But Jesus is Jesus is the only prophet in the Quran who heals. Muhammad never heals. So it's not unusual for Muslims who are sick to call on Jesus for healing. And I don't know about you, but I'm not going to insist on them articulating the Trinity before they call on Jesus for healing. All right, you just call on Jesus, let him tell you who he is. You know, that kind of thing. So, I would say probably, back to your question, probably China. All right, I think I'll make this our last question.
Sure. Hi, my name is James. I'm from Santa Monica, California. First, I would like to thank you so much for the seminar and for all the information that you presented for us today.
Thanks.
I've been very blessed by
all the information
you've shared.
I'm going to California. You guys are encouraging. Boston is like, hey, you're a meathead. You know? Go ahead.
My question is, while I am 100% sure that I would say everybody in this room is really working towards really finding our place in the world and really trying to make a difference as much as possible, I especially like what you were bringing up earlier about, you know, assuming positions of power in the corporate world and politically and in office, what are some things that we can do right now in the current position that we're in right now, preemptive to assuming those positions?
You mean positions of weakness, humility, and abject poverty of being a student? Yeah, that kind of thing. All right, that's a good one. Let me give you three things as soon as I think of them. The first and most basic one I would say is open your eyes. Open the eyes to the world that's right around you. I had to have someone tell me that two towns over from where I live, there were 12,000 Moroccan Muslims. You've got to go looking, but open your eyes. You know, come and see. Well, you start by seeing. Look for the people that are the marginalized. Look for the people that are the forgotten people. Look for the people on your campus that are international students and no one ever sits with them at the cafeteria. You know, open your eyes. Second thing I'd say is sort of open your checkbook. You still have checkbooks? You know what I mean, though. In context, open your debit cards, whatever. It has to go with open, though. Yeah. So, but you know, just because you don't have a lot of money doesn't mean you don't have anything. And I'm inspired by a group of students that got together and just with their small amount of money, pooled their money together, worked with a Christian organization, and started their own little microfinance bank in a poor community. You know, microfinance, you mean to make loans and everything. And then last but not least, open your heart. You know, because God, you might have surprises here at Urbana that God's going to direct you in a way you never thought of before. And it might just be somebody's statement, the one-off statement, somebody, the worship leader says something. And just, you know, keep your heart soft. I'll say this as by way of testimony in a negative way. The more exposure you get to the world's needs, the easier it is to become calloused. The easier it is to say, oh yeah, poverty. Hey, what's for lunch? You know, I mean, you just, because you see it all the time. That's why I love to tell people the word apathy, I don't know if you're aware of this, the word apathy doesn't mean you don't care. The word apathy means you don't feel. A is the negative in Greek, pathos. No feeling. So you're working like in my town, Boston, and the first time you have to step over a homeless person, I mean, you're just weeping. You're ready. You're going to buy gift certificates at McDonald's. You want to go help the person. The 12th time, you don't even see them anymore. That's apathy. And that's why I'd say keep your heart soft. Thank you very much. Have a great dinner. Great Urbana.